From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the November 2023 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Security and Insecurity, Part 2. Long-time listeners will remember that last year, as part of our 10th anniversary episode, we recorded an episode about security and insecurity at Bletchley Park. Now, Tom, ever since we recorded that episode, you've wanted to do a second one, haven't you?
Yeah, what I'm always interested in is the impact of the intelligence, of course,
yep.
And what difference it makes to the war. So what I wanted to bring in on that occasion was a bit of discussion about how security is maintained when intelligence is disseminated out from Bletchley Park to commanders in the field, to government, and so on.
We didn't really get a chance to do that, did we? Because it was so jam-packed of information just about more or less what happened behind the wire here at Bletchley Park. We didn't really move outside the wire, did we?
No, and we never got round to it, and we decided to separate it off and come back to it another time. So here we are.
Now, you say we, and last time, obviously, David was with us, but we had a very special guest for that episode. It was someone who'd been a very big supporter and a long-time friend of the podcast, and that was former departmental historian from GCHQ, Tony Comer. Now, who better to get back for this episode to look at the other side of the wire with Thomas than Tony Comer again? Hello, Tony.
Hello, Mark. Hello, Thomas.
Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, thank you.
I remembered the way.
Now, in this episode, as usual, we will have a few of our historical documents voiced for us by our dedicated voice team. In this episode, our special thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson and Owen Moogan. Well, introductions over, I think I'm going to throw it straight at you, Tom, and say, why do we need to look at the other side of the wire?
And I, in turn, I'm going to throw it straight to Tony. Because
okay.
Tony is the expert here. He's been there
is.
And done it. He's worked in the field, and he understands how this is done and what the problems are more than almost anybody else. So, Tony, can you tell us what is the fundamental problem which was facing Bletchley Park and, you know, the wider intelligence services during the war and trying to make use of the intelligence that they're gathering?
It's a problem that's much older than the Second World War, but I think it hits very strongly in the supply of intelligence from Bletchley Park. There's no point setting up a massive organisation to collect and process and decrypt and produce intelligence from all of the German and Axis communications unless you're going to use them for some reason. But there's equally no point in using the intelligence in such a way that your adversaries are going to realise that their secrets aren't secret and that therefore they're going to change the way they do things. How do you get the intelligence to the point at which it's really needed and let it be used in a way that doesn't alert the people whose secrets you've compromised to the fact that you know everything that they think you don't know?
So you've got these two contrasting imperatives. And is it a matter of balance? Is it a matter of achieving a balance between the two? Are they directly contradictory in that way, would you say?
I think there's a range of different elements to the problem. There's how easy is it, for example, to find a plausible alternative source for the information that you're trying to disguise? How good is your enemy's intelligence service? Can you assume that they will actually try to work out why you've done things in a particular way? How adept are the people who are going to read the intelligence that you send them at interpreting it and understanding how fragile the source might be? And then turning all of that on its head, will you save lives by using the intelligence? Because the last thing you're going to do is have information that could protect the lives of your own people and not use it.
Right, yeah. And listeners to our podcast will know immediately that this isn't the case, but we quite often run into this myth, really, about how Bletchley Park's intelligence is used, which is that simultaneously it's one of the most important factors in Allied victory. It practically wins the war, and it saves however million lives in the process. But it's as a result of that value, it's so secret that it can almost never be used. And you have, I mean, the classic example is the Coventry myth, is that Churchill allows Coventry to be bombed to protect the ultra secret. But many other minor examples which we hear of, where apparently the Allies aren't able to actually act on what they've learned. And of course, if that was the case, this is a complete paradox, because if they never used the intelligence, it couldn't have had the impact that people think it did. So one reason I wanted to talk about this is to bust that myth. I love busting a myth, as people will have heard in the past. And regular listeners will know the Allies are using this intelligence in an enormous way. But they are being very careful about how they do that. They do find a way to walk that tightrope, guaranteeing security while making very widespread use of this intelligence. And that's what's really interesting.
And it's a process. It starts out that intelligence is used in a fairly poor manner. It's difficult to get intelligence to the commands as it's needed. And it's a process that gradually improves. There's another complication that our principal allies from the United States really favour a different way of handling the intelligence. It's a caricature, but they're keener to use the intelligence, whereas the British are keener to protect the source. But it's an additional tension that's added increasingly from 1943 onwards as US forces become involved with the British. And then finally, the way it works in the European theatre is completely different from the way it works in the Pacific theatre. So it's a complex question, and it'll be interesting to see how many of the different bits of the question we're actually able to shine a light on in this conversation.
Absolutely. Let's get on with it then.
Now, Tony, you say the way it's disseminated improves during the war. When we think of it, and probably when our listeners think of it, we mention SLUs and SCUs all the time, but that's later in the war. How does it begin? How do we start those early campaigns?
When the British Expeditionary Force goes to France in September 1939, there is a small unit of SIGINT personnel who are attached to the GHQ, the general headquarters of the Expeditionary Force. And they have some mobile collection assets. And in fact, the Royal Air Force has an interception site on the Île Sainte-Marguerite in the Mediterranean, where the man in the iron mask was held, oddly enough. There isn't really much of a question of dissemination as an important part of what's going on, because it's a phony war. There's little enemy wireless traffic that can be intercepted on the front that separates the German forces and the British and French forces. And the German air traffic is fairly minimal because they're not doing, at that point, regular raids against the United Kingdom. So some linkages are established. There's a teleprinter link, for example, from the unit attached to GHQ to Bletchley Park, but the quality of the line is so poor that it's not actually of any significant use. The idea had been to pass unbreakable encrypted messages back to Bletchley from the front so that the decrypt could be passed forward, but it doesn't work. By the time the hot war starts, when the Germans invade Scandinavia and attack Belgium and Holland, there's really not any progress being made. And certainly in the Norway campaign, there's no way of sending intelligence to the British forces that are disembarked in the north of Norway. Certainly no way of sending any intelligence based on SIGINT.
The Norway campaign is a real missed opportunity for SIGINT intelligence, isn't it? Because HUT-6 are breaking the yellow key used in Norway, and they're breaking it on a very large scale. And because the Germans don't have those landline links, they're putting everything on the radio, and it's good operational traffic. And I suppose one of the myths about HUT-6 is that it builds up over time. Actually, it builds up to a very high level very early on. They're reading a large proportion, if not a majority, of German operational traffic in Norway because the cipher security is relatively poor. But they haven't got any way of getting it out to the field, so nobody's acting on it. It's going to London, it's going to MI6, and it's not being acted on, isn't it? And so you have that problem with customers as well. Exactly the same problem the naval section is having at this point. And we know the famous story about Harry Hinsley trying to warn the Admiralty at the same time about the threat to HMS Glorious.
Well, they were, of course, very standoffish to begin with. It took quite a long time, and one or two, well, perhaps I could say disasters, before you got their respect. They had no more idea of the need for meticulousness in studying this kind of thing than fly. So they couldn't see what we were beginning to be able to see from it. And first we had commotion before the Germans went to Norway, on which I was able to say, look, there is commotion. I don't know what it is, but they didn't take any notice. They didn't take any notice of a lot of other information either before Norway. But then, more seriously, I did give them warning from this external study that big ships were leaving the Baltic, or were preparing to. And I pressed them a bit, and they wouldn't send a signal out. And then, of course, the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau, two battle cruisers, sank one of our aircraft carriers, the Glorious, without any warning at all. But they quickly turned their cheek after that.
So that quotation, I think, tells us about two separate problems that there are. The first is that as far as the armed forces are concerned, as far as the service ministries are concerned, they are the customers for Bletchley Park's intelligence output. Now, today, your instinct would be that the person who needs the intelligence is the person at the front line who actually needs to know exactly where his enemy is and what he's doing. But whatever the doctrinal difference about should you send to a military intelligence headquarters or should you send to the operational headquarters, there was no practical way of sending the intelligence to Norway, to the British forces who were there. The intelligence would require much greater protection in terms of cipher security than was actually available. There was no way of sending messages to the British forces in Norway in a sufficiently strong cipher on sufficiently safe channels for it to be handled properly at the distant end. And then how would they use it? The question that we've started off with. What would they do with any information that they were given? That problem was never resolved. By the time people started to think about it in detail, British forces were already being withdrawn. Intelligence did get through to the British GHQ in France, but it was not really as relevant as the intelligence being produced in Norway. The main thrust of the German armed forces was across the French border. And while French SIGINT was producing copious amounts of material at the tactical level, the UK's intelligence really was mainly focused on Luftwaffe operations in France, and they weren't really able to provide any sort of intelligence that would help guide the battle. So by the middle of 1940, you have British forces withdrawn from Europe completely, and the knowledge that whatever had been thought of before the war as the ideal way to send intelligence forward, it wasn't working in an environment in which a principal source of intelligence, Enigma, was too important to be sent by ordinary channels because there wasn't anybody at the far end to receive it.
We have seen during the Battle of France, though, haven't we, the origins of what will become the special liaison units. Am I right in thinking?
Yeah, you've seen the fact that there is not just collection units, but there is an embedded SIGINT unit alongside the GHQ. But it's not getting the sort of intelligence that the GHQ needs to be able to fight the particular sort of battle that was there. This goes back to pre-war planning, that you know that the British Expeditionary Force would be accompanied by elements of military SIGINT that would go out in support.
There's a very heavy emphasis, isn't there, on tactical why and support for commanders on the front line.
There is, and in fact, there is an order sent out to the SIGINT units attached to the BEF that they are there to work at the command of the BEF, that they aren't to be directed from the UK. They are a force that's been deployed to support that particular command. Of course, that doesn't work when you're trying to deal with Enigma, which is never going to be able to be broken in the field. So it's another part of the lessons identified process from the campaign in France and looking forward to ways of doing this differently in the future.
What you need is a system which is separate and in sort of, in a way, above military commanders and controlled centrally from the UK.
I think it may be slightly differently and say that for the Signals Intelligence Organisation, its key thing is, can messages that need to be broken back in the UK be sent back quickly enough? And then how is that intelligence processed and used? The service point of view is that the messages any given collection site takes should be sent back to Bletchley, and Bletchley simply send back the decrypts to the people who intercepted the signals in the first place. So imagine Bletchley are getting intercepted messages from three different places, all come back to the UK where they're broken, and just the decrypted messages are sent back to these three separate units. It's no way to run an intelligence war. The point of intelligence is that you need to collate as much information as possible and present a unified product from what's being taken. But this is fundamentally different to the way that the army in particular conceive of the use of intelligence, that its sole function is to support commands at the tactical level.
So there isn't really a good system of distribution during the Battle of France, but it is the place, is it not, where we kind of see the origins of what become the SLUs. Do they learn lessons from France?
They begin to learn lessons, but they learn them slowly. Once a British force goes to Athens after the attacks on Greece.
So this is early 1941.
Yes. The system changes in that materials being sent to the headquarters, still from the War Office in London, but it's being sent to people who, it's paraphrased information. It's not the direct information that the Germans are sending to each other. It's paraphrases, but it's going to people who've been told what the source of the information is. This is maybe something we'll talk about later on. It's an improvement, and of course there's good intelligence being produced from Enigma traffic on German intentions. It falls down in Crete. Crete was an example where the supply of ultra intelligence to General Freyberg was something that was referred right up the chain. And it was Churchill who said that ultra reports couldn't be sent to Crete, only the barest of paraphrases. It was pretty obvious that the Battle of Crete was going to be a difficult one. And Churchill did not want there to be anything to suggest to the Germans that ultra was playing a significant part.
So yeah, Freyberg's actions on Crete have been a subject of a lot of discussion. Commanding the New Zealand Division, he's in charge of the defence. And Hut 6 have actually succeeded, haven't they, in reading the entire German invasion plan. They know everything in plenty of time. But my understanding is that Freyberg is unsure about the source of the intelligence and unsure about how far he's allowed to actually act upon it. Is that your understanding?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. It's complicated, of course, by the fact that Freyberg had a long time to think about what might have happened before he actually wrote his memoirs. And it became enmeshed in the whole sort of question of the Battle of Crete and whose fault was it that the battle had been lost and what have you. The key point, however, is that Freyberg himself wasn't clear on what intelligence there was and how to use it. And I think this also then feeds into a general feeling back in the UK, we've got to change the way we do this. This isn't working. That's the point, I think, at which we start thinking about the SLU that was set up in Cairo. Why was that model chosen?
German air superiority was complete. An army without a single plane faced an airborne, air-supported army for the first time in history. May 20th, at dawn, it began. 1 hour of terrific bombing at Malmi and Kania, crushing the troops to ground, shattering AA gun crews, pounded into slit trenches the British could not observe. In the first day, the Germans landed 750 glider troops and 7,200 parachutists. Losses were so appalling that the high command was forced either to give up or launch a full-scale attack. They chose to hurl 35,000 airborne troops and their whole striking force against Crete. The Germans abandoned sea convoys, resorted to air transport alone. The troop planes packed Malmö, multiplying the German strength. A continuous swarm of transports coming to unload and going back for more flew low across the British lines to shake morale.
The first Special Signals Unit, as it was called originally, arrived in Cairo in June 1941. Six officers, 36 other ranks, and five vehicles. The really important bit was that they had their own communications back to the UK and their own encryption systems, and so could work independently of the rest of the military communications infrastructure. By September 1941, these have already been split into the first SLU and SCU to be operational.
Okay, so let's just take a step back at this point and define what we're talking about, because we aerially refer to SLUs all the time, but I don't know if we've ever got down into the weeds and talked about what that specifically means. So your first unit, it's organised at Warden Hall, isn't it? So That's MI6 Communications, Section 8. And they buy up a load of Packard touring cars, don't they? And outfit them with radios. And we've got an example in our garages here. And so the emphasis at the beginning is on communications, isn't it? It's having that unique communications link. And later on, that's the role taken by the Special Communications Unit element. And they're run by Wadden. The SLUs are separate, the Special Liaison Unit, half of the pairing. And my understanding is it's organised under Section 2 of SIS, which is the air section, under Frederick Winterbottom, who many of our listeners will be familiar with. He's the man who publishes The Ultra Secret in 1974 and brings this all to public knowledge. But he's quite heavily involved during the war, of course, as well. And the Special Liaison Unit's job is to handle security, isn't it? Cipher security on the communications link. So they decipher the traffic when they receive it, or they decipher the messages when they receive them. And they are the ones who make sure when they share decrypts with the commanders that none of this material goes missing. It's all kept securely the whole time it's in the commander's possession, and then it's returned and disposed of securely. But also they're there to advise the commander on how he may act on the intelligence as well. So you have this very clear distinction between communications and security in the two different teams. And they're actually organised accordingly under those two different parts of MI6, which means that normally your SCU personnel are Army and your SLU personnel are Air Force, simply because of that administrative convenience.
With the SCU and SLU, they've managed to solve the conundrum of how to get valuable intelligence securely in as rapid a way as possible to a frontline headquarters. The SCU is in charge of the mechanics of getting messages that have been encrypted in the UK, containing intelligence, right through to the command headquarters. And at the command headquarters, the Special Liaison Unit is responsible for decrypting the message, seeing what the intelligence is, advising the intelligence officer at the command where they're working that there is information that he needs to see and that his command needs to see, and ensuring that while that intelligence is in the headquarters, it's being handled properly, not being misused, and then, as you say, and importantly, it's being disposed of properly once it's been used. This is a radical departure. There isn't anything like this before 1941. It's a direct result of the lessons learned from the campaigns in France and Norway, and is the start of a model that eventually is going to spread across the armed forces.
And it's a very robust solution, and it works, doesn't it? And it goes on right to the end of the war in pretty much the same format as comes about in Cairo in middle of 1941.
Yeah, they've actually got it right the first time. There's lots of work to do. There's lots of work to do about things like access, about knowing who within a headquarters is entitled to see the intelligence and who's not. There's the whole question of the cover. what is this SCU and SLU doing? What do the SCU say to other communicators in the theatre? What's the relationship between the special liaison unit and the intelligence branch of the headquarters? There are lots of niggly details to sort out, but the fundamental structure is there, and to a large extent, I think you could say, is there today, that there's a single system that carries intelligence between the intelligence producers and the consumers, if you like, at the distant end, who need this intelligence. And there are people alongside the headquarters that's been deployed who can help interpret the messages that have been sent and who can liaise back with the intelligence producers to answer specific questions.
So the question of helping with interpretation leads us quite neatly on to the last component of this system, which we need to understand, which is the twist the Americans put on it, because they have an extra component, which are special officers known as representatives or signal security officers, SSOs. And that's a uniquely American innovation, which the British don't emulate. And there's quite a lot of confusion about the SSOs, because sometimes you will see the claim that actually the Americans establish their own SLUs and do it for themselves. And that's a misunderstanding of what the SSOs are there to do. What it comes down to is the Americans are concerned that getting a British source of intelligence, there will be problems of presentation and problems of language potentially and problems of interpretation, and to overcome those for the benefit of their commanders. And we have to remember their commanders are, and their intelligence staffs in general, when they're receiving SLUs for the first time, they're much less experienced than the British staffs normally at most of the headquarters. And they're getting this stuff for the first time. So people like General Marshall and General Eisenhower decide that they need a sort of middleman to help them process Ultra at the headquarters, and that's the role of a special signals officer.
And the difference there is that the SSO is a SIGINT-trained officer. There are no SIGINT-trained officers at a British general headquarters. There's a blister on the side, if you like, with the SLU, where the specialists have been deployed, but who aren't actually part of the headquarters as such. They're a unit that's there to support the intelligence staff.
And the British assumption is always that there's this academic purity in it, that the intelligence staff should take all sources of intelligence and they should treat them equally and they should digest all of it and come to their own conclusions. And that's why they're fairly sceptical about the American idea of having a special officer just dealing with Ultra, because inevitably he will focus on Ultra to the detriment of other intelligence and everyone else at the command will be that much more distant from the Ultra. So there are benefits to having that specialist, but also potentially quite major downsides.
I think this is a problem that exists right up to today. SIGINT isn't easy to understand, and you need trained people who can interpret the SIGINT to get the maximum value from it. And you're also right that all source assessment, what was called in the Second World War appreciation, was not something that should or could be done by a single intelligence agency. The problem then, as now, is that to have the assessment done by people who were essentially tourists, people who would come into an intelligence post for 2 or 3 years and then move on, very British idea that any reasonably educated person using his own common sense would be able to see their way through traffic, didn't work. It was not a good system. But as you say, you have to counterbalance that with the idea of having a SIGINT expert inside the headquarters who will naturally understand only one of the sources of intelligence that are available in the command, and getting that balance to make sure that SIGINT is properly understood whilst it still only forms one part, but not necessarily one equal part, of the intelligence input to the headquarters is really complicated and still something that has to be regularly looked at all the time today.
And what I just want to make really clear for the listener is that the role of the SSO does not overlap with the role of the SLU, does it? He's not in charge of the SLU. His job is not with security per se. It's with interpretation. And if you actually look at the history of the SLUs, they say the system worked quite well, whether it's the British system or the American system, we weren't too fussed. But the author notes that there were some suggestions that either officers from the SLU should support the SSO in his interpretation work, or that the SSO should actually be placed in charge of the SLU. What the history of the SLU says is that neither of these are very good ideas, because SLU officers are not trained in interpretation. They're not trained SIGINTers, as you say. They're security officers. And on the other hand, the SSO, as a trained SIGINTer, doesn't know enough about security to oversee that side of the work. And there's this danger of people at a slightly higher level who don't really get it, mixing the two up in a way that modern historians sometimes have mixed the two up.
Yeah.
But they're very distinct jobs. And what it comes down to is your SLU is an interchangeable cog in the machine, and they can be moved around between different headquarters, and they are moved around, and they perform exactly the same function wherever they are, and they follow the regulations to the letter, and that's what they're there for. The SSOs, they need to get to know the headquarters, they need to get to know the general they're serving, they need to understand how they get on with the rest of his headquarters and how they need to brief that particular commander, what he reacts to and how he needs to have the intelligence interpreted to him. And that means they can't be moved around. They have to stay at one headquarters and get to know it and stay there for the duration. So even though there's been this confusion between the two, they're actually very distinct roles performed by the SLU and the SSO.
Very distinct roles. And in fact, it's the SSO role, ironically, that develops 60 years later in the UK system into what's now called the GCO, the Government Communications Officer.
Special intelligence will be passed to commanders-in-chief in the field through these special British units provided for this purpose. The officer in command of these units will have direct access to the commander-in-chief and advise as necessary on the security aspect of handling and using this intelligence. Where an American officer is commander-in-chief, an American officer, properly trained and indoctrinated at Bletchley Park, will be attached to the unit to advise and act as liaison officer to overcome difficulties that may arise in regard to differences in language. Extract from the 1943 BRUSA Agreement.
Now, historically, we're told, you know, 30 people in the whole of Britain know about ULTRA at the height of the war. We know that's wrong. So is there an actual list of who can see ULTRA? How's that maintained? Who maintains it? For example, do people who are on the list know who else is on the list? Between you, can you answer that whole bunch of questions I've got there?
Can I tell you what I know, which is not very much? I know I've seen two lists. There's a couple of lists in the documents we have access to from very early in the war, and each of them have about 20 names on them, and one of them is all the officers with knowledge of ULTRA at that point, which I think is in early 1940.
So this is probably where we get this, only X number of people knew about ULTRA.
Yeah, possibly. I think we have it on in one of our displays. And there's another list associated with the Navy, all the naval officers.
Right.
And what's interesting about that list is it's been updated with some handwritten entries, which seems a bit informal, but it's being it's being added to.
Okay.
And what I've never seen is anything that looks like a sort of late war list that must have hundreds, if not thousands, of names on it. I presume this is being kept track of, but traditionally it's something we attribute to Winterbottom because he's supposed to be the man who was in charge of ULTRA security and ULTRA distribution. And he's the one doing a lot of the indoctrination of commanders personally, or at least coordinating other people to do that work for him. But I've never seen Winterbottom's list. But come to think of it, I have no proof that it actually exists. So I'm really interested in Tony's professional insight into how this would have been managed.
I don't think, apart from the ones you're referring to from early 1940, I don't think there are any lists as such surviving. And I very, very much doubt whether there was ever a time when there was an army list, an RAF list, a navy list, a civilian list. It doesn't make sense. I think what you had was the identification of posts which needed to have full clearance. And you can see this to a certain extent. I think it's best illustrated in the OIC in the Admiralty, where the Operational Intelligence Centre, which received all intelligence coming into the Admiralty for dissemination to HM ships around the world. And there was pretty careful thought given to which posts needed access to ULTRA information and which posts might not see directly the product from Bletchley, but would know that the information they were receiving was based on intercepted messages and would be able to guess that this was something rather more serious than just listening to the German radio or anything like that. And that's the way they thought of it. First of all, which are the posts that need to be filled by people with clearance? And then who's available to fill those posts? One of the examples of security concerns a Royal Signals officer who was supposed to be posted to India to manage something like an SCU. And it was discovered while he was being vetted, in today's language, for the post, that he had a wife who was a member of the Communist Party. And he was therefore pulled out of this posting, but only A, after he'd been fully indoctrinated, and B, after he'd been told that he'd be getting a promotion to go there. And he was left a quite embittered man because he'd lost the promotion and he'd lost this posting. And of course, he was now being threatened that if he ever spoke of any of the information he'd learned, he would be in serious trouble. But it's an illustration of the sort of thing that happened. Identify a post that needs to be filled by someone with a clearance, identify a potential candidate, and then run a fairly basic vetting of that person.
So what I'm thinking now is, if there's no central list, there can't be really any central oversight. Nobody can be keeping an eye on all these people to make sure they don't give anything away. So it places a lot of importance on the indoctrination procedure, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because if you have your list of posts that need to know about Ultra, and you indoctrinate everybody who's in one of those posts, and you make sure you do it properly, then that's your safeguard. Even if they move into another job, they know they're never going to be at liberty to discuss any of what they've been working on. So what do we know about how that process is done?
We don't know as much as you might think, because the information wasn't really thought of as anything worth keeping once the war was over and all these people had been demobbed.
And like everything to do with Bletchley, it's all being done on an ad hoc basis and not really written down.
Pretty well, because if you know that the person in charge of Italian destroyers in the Operational Intelligence Centre in the Admiralty is a cleared post, you can look at the Navy list and see who filled that post successively. You need to know who had been cleared. You've got their names there. Or conversely, if you want to see what happened to the guy who was in the post in 1941, go to the Navy list and see what his subsequent postings were, or go to Admiralty Personnel Department and just find out where somebody is. It's always doable without having to have some great centralised list. And if you'd had a great centralised list, where would you have kept it? Who would have been responsible for keeping it? How would you keep it up to date? How many cleared clerks would you need just to maintain this list? What would the classification of the list be? That, you know, thinking back to the mentality of people in the 1940s, just the protection of the list would have been, well, like an employment scheme.
It turns into a logistical nightmare quite
just
quickly.
Just to keep lots and lots of people working and doing something that didn't actually need to be done.
But what's really interesting about this all is that it emphasises how much of this system is just built on trust. And I think that's something that's very hard for people to understand. They think, well, this stuff is secret, and therefore it must have been kept secret by having a sort of overbearing central authority looming over people, making sure that they followed the rules. But there is no such authority. There's always the risk. There's always the threat of action if you break the rules. But as we talked about in the last episode about security, if you're prosecuting people after they've given the secret away, the horse has bolted. It's too late. And so it's about putting an immense amount of trust in people from the very get-go. And what it involves, I think, is another paradox, which is that to get people to really understand why they need to keep the secret, they need to know quite a lot. They need to know, at the very minimum, that the stuff they're handling is from enemy communications of the highest security. And that is firstly why it's valuable, and secondly why it must be kept absolutely secret. If you try and maintain a situation where people are given Ultra without really knowing what it is, that's actually prejudicial to security, because it makes them more likely to give something away. Whereas you have to reduce the secrecy and give them quite a bit of information to ensure the system's going to remain secure. Do you agree with me on that? Do you think?
I think you're exactly right. I'll add another couple of footnotes, though, just to make it a bit more complicated. The first is the role of the local security officer. The local security officer can be the tyrant. He's the person who goes round offices at night and sees if people leave pieces of paper out that should be locked away. This is at Bletchley, and it's also at any deployed headquarters. Anywhere where there's this information, there's going to be somebody who's responsible for physical security. And part of physical security is making sure people don't do stupid things, or at least people don't do stupid things that threaten the source of intelligence. And these people can be more or less little Hitlers. You know, they can be overbearing and dominant, or they can just be the sort of person who says, look, you left the window of your office open last night, don't do it again. And that means there's always a little check. It's something you're always aware of. The other sort of footnote, and it can sometimes be a bit of a danger, is the number of people for whom being in the know and knowing things that other people don't know actually gives them a bit of a kick. The sort of secret squirrel mentality. I know things that other people don't know. And, you know, the pain's in the neck. You know, what do you do in your secret room? I can't tell you, but I'm now 6 inches taller.
And the last thing you want people to do is go and tell their mates down the pub that they know things that they're not allowed to tell them.
Yeah.
So the very fact of secrecy must be kept secret as far as possible.
As far as possible, but it's the sort of thing that breaks down. It's so much easier when somebody says, what do you do? And you can say, I can't tell you, I'm afraid, it's hush, hush. And it just becomes a non-issue. But if people can be trained of the importance of the work, and it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because when you've talked to veterans and they've taught you about knowing things and not being able to tell people who they think, you know, would have a direct personal interest.
Saturday, 3rd of February, 1945. Learned from a source which cannot be quoted, intercepts of Japanese communications, that my son Mungo's submarine was sunk on the 12th in the Malacca Straits as a result of two separate attacks, first by depth charge and then by air. There is just a chance, therefore, that he may have been able to escape before the Porpoise sank and have swum ashore or been picked up by the Japanese. It is somewhat ironic that I cannot mention this information to dear old Margaret, my wife, or anyone else as yet, and must, for the time being, keep it to myself. Saturday, the 17th of February, 1945. The Admiralty has now officially announced that the Porpoise is long overdue and must be considered lost, though no other details are given, and there is no further news of dear old Mungo.
Extract from the diaries of Malcolm Kennedy, held at Sheffield University. Kennedy was a member of GCNCS from 1935 and in Bletchley Park's Japanese military section from 1942.
So you've got all of these people in the ministries in London, at headquarters around the world, who are cleared. Very few of them will actually know any detail at all about what's happened at Bletchley Park. Code breaking is probably as near as they would get. There are people who do visit, but even then, the people who visit are interested in the material that's being produced.
Yeah, they're going to Hut Free and they're lecturing to them, and they're interested in intelligence analysis because that's what they're getting and what they understand a bit more about. And what the boffins, the backroom boffins, as Winterbottom refers to them, with their, he calls the bomb machine the bronze goddess, doesn't he? He's clearly got no idea what it is or what it does.
Absolutely no idea whatsoever.
And he's a member of SIS. Yes. So how can the generals be expected to have any knowledge?
Yeah.
This is a really interesting point to make.
And you'll get then the people in the ministries who are getting product that they know comes from decryption, sometimes with annotation from Hut 3, who'll actually be explaining contextually what a message might mean if it's written in language that's particularly complex. But they won't know the details. There's no need to know the details and probably wouldn't understand the details of what people had been doing here, even if they had a chance to talk about the work to people.
And that is a reason Hut 3 works the way it does, isn't it? But when it presents information, they're very careful to make sure it is an accurate representation of what the Germans said in their own messages. So it can't be misinterpreted in that sense. There's no doubt about whether a British analyst has added their opinion to things, unless it's bracketed off as a clear comment. And the other thing that they do is that they make sure, at the same time as being an accurate representation of what the Germans are saying, that this stuff is understandable to your average Allied commander, whether he's an Air Force or Army commander. And this is why they have the military analysts on hand, to make sure there's no doubt about the interpretation of the message when it comes in. They don't expect these people to be able to do their own interpretation to really understand how you do SIGINT analysis. They do all that work for them. And the slight complexity caused by the presence and commands of your SSOs and your intelligence officers. But Hupfree tries to take all the uncertainty out of the equation because they know the customer is a specialist in fighting the war, but not a specialist in intelligence.
Absolutely.
You've both made it clear that we don't really have a list, but if you're on this non-existent list, so you have been indoctrinated into Ultra, does that mean you know everything?
Not by a long way. This is a really important point because that misconception has had its effect on the historiography.
I think that's what a lot of people expect, yeah.
Yeah, people do think he's indoctrinated, therefore he knows everything. And by contrast, if somebody shows any lack of knowledge about Ultra,
they don't know anything.
They can't have been indoctrinated.
Yeah.
And a really good example of this is Bomber Harris, Arthur Harris, who's in charge of Bomber Command, who certain of the books will tell you didn't receive Ultra. He did receive Ultra. We will discuss this at length
next
in a future
year.
Episode. But for now, I'll just say part of that misconception comes from the fact that when Harris talks about the intelligence he gets, he's quoted as saying something along the lines of, I didn't know the source of the intelligence, but I got everything I needed to get. And that's been interpreted in certain quarters as Harris saying, I did not know what Ultra was.
And I guess this quote is post-war?
Yes, so he speaks about this in the, I think, early 80s.
Oh, so the secret's out by then?
Yeah. So he's allowed to speak about this. Some people have interpreted this as Harris not being aware of the source in the sense of not getting the material. I think what he's saying is he was getting the material, but he didn't understand where it was coming from. He hadn't been to Bletchley. He knows nothing of code breaking.
Yeah.
And he knows nothing about enemy communications because he has people to do that for him. All he knows is he's getting this stuff. It is from enemy communications. The details he does not have to worry about, and he can rely on it, and he's using it. Therefore, he's indoctrinated. And that is pretty representative of most Allied generals.
I think that's especially so of Harris. I think you get the impression that's the kind of guy he is. He gets the information. He doesn't need to know where it's coming from because he's just got it and he's going to use it.
Yeah, and so commanders have different attitudes. And Monty is very much in the same vein.
Yep.
And lets his intelligence chief, Bill Williams, handle this all for him. And Patton as well has no interest in doing intelligence himself and lets Oscar Koch at his headquarters handle it all for him. And then you have General Alexander, who has his own Ultra room in the Palace of Caserta, where he goes and reviews all this material personally.
His own Ultra room?
Yeah, so what this leads us on to is how do you handle Ultra at commands?
Yes, that would lead us into that quite well, actually, yes. Gentlemen.
So we have very good accounts, and Alexander is only one among several, where the material is being kept at headquarters, filed away, plotted on maps, kept for later retrieval. And we know, at the same time, the model they're trying to follow is that the special liaison officer lets the commander see a decrypt for only as long as he needs to absorb its meaning and then immediately takes it back and disposes of it. But in reality, that's just not a practical proposition because you do need to do this all-source intelligence analysis at the headquarters. You do need to hang on to this stuff. And it's just one example of the rules being bent at the headquarters.
I draw my breath slightly there by saying I don't think at that point it's the rule being bent so much as an example of evolution, something that wouldn't have been possible 2 years earlier in Cairo. You've now got in Caserta, you've got Alexander in charge of an army group. And by this time, the dissemination of intelligence has become institutionalized. You know, the idea of this small SLU blistered onto the side of a deployed headquarters handling this ultra-secret information in the field is something new, and everybody's saying we've got to take the maximum care. And as you say, once the information in this ultra-message has been digested by the recipient, the message has to be destroyed and no record kept. Records, if any, are kept and would have been kept in the UK, so we don't need to. By the time they're in Caserta, it's a different sort of headquarters fighting in a different sort of war. He can afford to have an ultra room because that headquarters is going to remain stationary for a long period. I mean, obviously, nobody knew how far forward they'd be based there, but it was obvious they were going to be based there throughout the Italian campaign. The palace at Caserta was big enough that they could have a very secure set of rooms, including one that the general used when he wanted to go and read his special material and see the maps with the annotations put on. But I think it tells you how rapidly the dissemination process has been evolved so that a static headquarters can actually have a much better integrated SIGINT service than a mobile or potentially mobile headquarters would have. I think what happens with Alexander is only possible because of the success that they had with the 8th Army in North Africa and the way that intelligence was used there. But I wouldn't want people to think that that was bending the rules. I think by then the rules had evolved.
It is, again, an ad hoc process.
Absolutely.
But you're absolutely right to make that point. And I actually have some evidence of this evolution because we know about Caserta, but a couple of years earlier, actually in Algeria, at the headquarters of 1st Army, I found an account of the rules being followed actually pretty much down to the letter, even though it was against the wishes of the commanding general in charge.
We were on attachment to the Army HQ and had responsibility for security of the unit and particularly for the security of the ultra-intelligence material fed to General Anderson. In this respect, we were under the clear orders of Chiefs of Staff in London. This sometimes put us in some difficulties with a variety of majors and colonels who, of course, were not in our picture. Often they tried to pull rank on me, at the time a flight lieutenant. The most notable event was a brush with General Anderson himself. Our modus operandi was that we handed a message to Colonel Dornay, Anderson's number 2, and collected them for burning shortly afterwards. On one occasion, I found that a very high priority message had not been returned, and saw Dornay about this. He said although he'd asked Anderson for the message, he'd decided to keep it. He also said the General was going forward in the next few hours. This was obviously up to me, as Dornay refused to try again. Perspiring slightly, I went to see Anderson and asked for the message to be returned to me for destruction. He categorically refused to hand it back. I was obliged to remind him of the vital need for security of the source, both in necessity to avoid compromising the information by precipitate action, and the physical existence of the message itself. He claimed it was perfectly safe with him. I was obliged to tell him that I was under strictest orders to burn the message and report directly to Chief of Staff if prevented from doing so. Anderson was a dour, taciturn Scot, and with very bad grace indeed, pulled it out of his pocket and handed it to me.
Extract of John Lamont's recollections of SLU work at HQ 1st Army in North Africa from Voices of the Codebreakers, published in 2007.
That's quite interesting because the whole thing about Torch is an operation where for the first time, and the Anglo-American invasion of North Africa in November 1942, and they try to apply new lessons. They try to apply to this Anglo-American operation a whole scheme of SCUs, SLUs, permanent fixtures in Gibraltar, forces on board ships that are part of the invasion fleet. And it's this wonderful construction that lasts until the moment it meets reality. It's useless. It doesn't work. You've even got, in one point, you've got two people on the same ship who are both there in a SIGINT role, and neither of them knows that the other's there because they're from two different services. And it's what happens when strict rules designed in the UK without any reference to the people who are actually going to have to use them are applied properly and don't evolve pragmatically at the time.
When we did Torch to Tunis about a year ago, we talked quite a lot about how difficult they found it and how it didn't go all that well as a SIGINT campaign. So you've got John Lamont in North Africa having this argument and practically having to grab the Ultra out of General Anderson's hands to dispose of it. A bit later, you've got Alexander at Caserta and you have that evolution. But I've also got quite a bit of evidence about those American SSOs operating, and again, they're operating quite far forward, but again, there's an expectation that even if they just have a tent which is guarded with a couple of filing cabinets, they're going to need to keep a certain amount of records. And I would completely take your point, Tony, about these being guidelines rather than firm rules. But at the same time, I think there is quite a lot of evidence they are being bent. In the case of the SSOs having to improvise, and it's clear when they're reporting back to Telford Taylor at Bletchley Park, the man who trained them up, they're giving their feedback at the end of the war. about how they operated. And one of the points they've made is that not all of these regulations can be followed to the letter.
The independence of the representative by reason of his detached service status was stressed as an advantage in most of the reports. The representative was in a better position to enforce security measures in dealing with officers of higher rank than he would have been had he been an integral part of the command. Secondly, those representatives who served with commands whose G2 intelligence sections were inefficient and incompetent valued their semi-independent status highly. That status also resulted in a spree between the various representatives, which was of benefit in their relations with Hut 3 and with each other. Additionally, it afforded security cover within the command and decreased the possibility of local curiosities and jealousies. However, at least one representative, assuming World War III's top-ranking officers will be more security-minded and its G2 sections more competent, stated his belief that the advantage of having the Ultra operation completely integrated with the general work of the G2 section outweighed the advantages of independence, and recommended that the representative should be assigned to that section. Such a procedure would go far to eliminate whatever tendencies there may be for the Ultra representative to be isolated both in function and in his intelligence perspective from the rest of the G2 section.
Extract from Report on Experiences of Special Security Officers, Synthesis of Experiences in the Use of Ultra Intelligence by U.S. Army Field Commands in the European Theater of Operations.
But the other thing that comes up is talking about Ultra over the phone. I've got a couple of accounts on this. Bill Williams is one at Montgomery's headquarters who talks about how we weren't meant to discuss this stuff over the phone, but you can't run a war without picking up the phone and talking to people lower down the chain about material from Ultra. His argument was, as long as you don't refer to the source by name, as long as you obfuscate it in some way and refer to it in general terms, you have to be able to break that particular regulation about not discussing Ultra over the phone.
It was forbidden to discuss Ultra on the telephone overseas. This rule was daily and hourly disobeyed. Yet it is maintained that, had the enemy kept a full telephone log of the conversations between various intelligence officers at SHEF, 21st Army Group, and the armies, he would have been little the wiser about our sources of intelligence, although his morale might have been enhanced by the belief that intelligence against him was in the hands of frivolous illiterates. Every attempt was made in telephone conversations to use a cryptic and, to the overhearer, complicated form of conversation, which guaranteed communication but made little sense to anyone else. Telephone Chinese is a difficult accomplishment, because it can lead to misunderstandings and irritation. Had one been able to speak freely, it would have been better. Clearly, that was not a risk to be taken. We broke the rules because they were unworkable. They were, like most rules about the security of Ultra, drawn up so far as one could see without consultation with the consumer. The latter had to interpret them his own way. Yet if ever people realized the value of the commodity with which they were dealing, it was surely the customers.
Extract from The Use of Ultra by the Army by Edgar Bill Williams.
This takes us right back to where we started. There's no point in collecting and producing the intelligence unless you can use it. Out of the Second World War arose a more structured system of what's now called action on. How do you take action on SIGINT reports? And there are processes in place that everybody in the system understands to enable the information to be used. This didn't happen then. It's all part of a learning process. And yes, you're right. People like Bill Williams would do things like this, but A, he was very senior, and his boss, Montgomery, was so senior that he was protected when doing it.
If I could just give you one other example of the rules being bent, which is a really serious one, is these American Air Force officers in particular who like to fly along on missions and persist in doing this even after they've been indoctrinated, even though the rules, you know, one of the most fundamental regulations is that anyone with knowledge of Ultra must not put themselves in position to be captured by the enemy. One of the first officers to be indoctrinated is General Spartz, and he falls into this trap of being indoctrinated without realizing the consequences, and then too late realizes it's going to stop him flying on missions, and very reluctantly obeys the regulations. But a bit later on, General Eaker is going to come in, and he's going to be sent out to the Mediterranean to command Mediterranean Air Forces. And Spartz warns him, do not let Winterbottom indoctrinate you about Ultra, because if you do, you won't be able to fly. So Winterbottom turns up to indoctrinate him, And he says, no, I don't want to hear any of this. Don't involve me. And just says, no. And Winterbottom fails to indoctrinate him. And then Ika decides that this gives him permission to fly as much as he wants. And he ends up taking some crazy risks. On one occasion, he flies over the Abbey of Monte Cassino in Italy, just before they famously bomb it, to see if there's any Germans inside. And he does this in a light aircraft, like an artillery spotter aircraft, flying at only 200 feet. And apparently the only reason the Germans don't shoot him down is because they're worried about giving the positions away on the ground, because they could have just blown him out of the sky. And another thing he does is he flies over as part of Operation Frantic, which are the shuttle bomber missions, which fly right over Europe, bomb their target, and then land in Soviet territory. He leads the first of those missions personally. So he flies the whole breadth of Axis Europe. And despite not having been indoctrinated by Winterbottom, you know, he does know what Ultra is. He has heard of it. He does know this source exists. And that alone, you know, following maybe not the letter of the rules, but the spirit of the rules, is enough reason not to fly.
Well, just the fact he's told, don't let Winterbottom indoctrinate you into Ultra. He's bound to have said, and what's Ultra? Oh, well, it's just this secret code-breaking thing. But don't let him tell you about it.
Yeah. The fact, oh, I don't know all the details, that is no defence. Yeah. You know there's a secret source of intelligence. Another senior American Air Force man who does this is General Doolittle, who's in charge of the 8th Air Force, involved in strategic bombing from Britain.
Famous for bombing Tokyo.
Yeah, absolutely. He bombs Tokyo in 1942, but he's in Europe a bit later on. He's indoctrinated, and he curtails his activities, but he still goes along on bombing missions over France. He says that he never goes that deep over enemy territory, so it's okay. One thing he does is on D-Day, he takes up a P-38, a Lightning, and flies back and forth over the invasion beaches, watching the troops go ashore, because he just can't resist being involved. And this filters down to his subordinates. The most senior American airman captured by the Germans during the war is a man called Arthur Vanneman, who is Doolittle's intelligence man. Obviously, he's indoctrinated. And Doolittle gives him permission to go along on a bombing raid. And what happens is the bomber isn't actually shot down, but it's hit by flak and there's a large amount of smoke in the aircraft. So the order comes to bail out. And about four of the crew bail out before the pilot realises that it's not that serious and they actually fly back to base. But by that point, Vanneman's bailed out. He lands, he gets injured in the drop. He gets captured by the Germans pretty quickly. And luckily, the Germans don't realise the prize that's fallen into their hands. They know he's a high-up air officer, but they don't interrogate him thoroughly enough to discover what he knows, and Vanneman manages to keep it to himself. But he's in Stalag Luft III. He's in the camp that is famous from The Great Escape. He is the most senior prisoner, and he's got full knowledge the entire time. And it's not just the Americans that are doing this, because there is actually a British officer who is a Bomber Command base commander, but he'd previously served at Air Ministry working on D-Day planning, so he had knowledge. And he goes along on a raid, and the same thing happens on his raid. Really unlucky, because his is the only plane shot down in that raid. Again, he gets captured. And again, the Germans don't manage to capitalise on it. These are not reasonable interpretations of the regulations. This is just what happens when you trust people to follow the rules, and sometimes they don't. And with the Air Force, that's a real problem. There is this inevitable need to use the phone and sort of disseminate information through slightly unofficial channels in the field. And this is a subject of discussion, even in the closing months of the war. And I found some evidence of this amongst the American SSOs about how they're meant to handle discussing Ultra over the phone.
To XA, from SLU, 6th Army Group, 7th of January, 1945. The security problem arises because of growing tendency to make oblique references to Ultra intelligence in following manners. A. BT numbers, i.e. message serials. B. C-Gardiner, or C-Bussy, i.e. named recipients. C. That other stuff. D. An agent, prisoner of war, or documentary item often identified by subject matter is confirmed, or hard. E. Very indirect references to area or unit involved in a recent message. A field telephone is easily tapped, and Alsace, at least, is undoubtedly thick with agents. It is also probable that a small proportion of the calls go over radio lines, with the talkers unaware or forgetful of the fact. The notoriously systematic enemy cannot be expected to receive a number of such cryptic references without at least speculating as to the nature of the special intelligence.
We've heard how it starts off quite shambolic at the start of the war. As the war continues, we start building up this really professional dissemination of information. at the end of the war, does that carry on or does it change? Is it all forgotten about? You know, what happens?
Obviously, the units that were there to support the fight against the Germans or in the Far East, the war against the Japanese, they're disbanded. But the British Army of the Rhine is formed in Germany, and very quickly its SIGINT mission is the Soviet Union and the Eastern European countries that have become communist. And within the army headquarters, you know, from a very early stage in 1946, if I remember correctly, there is a SIGINT unit that's formed to interpret the material on the Soviet bloc that's coming in to the British Army's the Rhine Command. You see, for example, in Malaya in the 50s and the 60s, how SIGINT provides direct support to British and Commonwealth soldiers in their fights against the Indonesians. You can see both of those examples are in John Ferris's authorised history of GCHQ. And coming up to the modern day, you can actually see here in Bletchley Park an example of how things work today. The cabin that was used by government communication officers, who are the modern GCHQ representatives who deploy when a British or Allied military headquarters deploy. One of the cabins that was used in Afghanistan is now on permanent display here at Bletchley Park.
And so these are the modern equivalents of not quite the SLUs, but they're more like the American SSOs, aren't they? Because they help with interpretation.
Exactly. Perhaps they're a combination of both. The idea is here is GCHQ in a box that's put alongside command to support with its own comms, its own ability to support. The major difference between then and now is that the GCO is much, much more likely to be a civilian than to be military. To have a civilian there, somebody who is a GCHQ professional, somebody who can be embedded in a headquarters, but still speak the language that people in Cheltenham speak, and can therefore interpret what the headquarters wants and pass that back to Cheltenham to prompt better, more timely intelligence production. The other thing that strikes me when we're talking is that if you read most of the books about what happened at Bletchley Park, you'll see a focus on cryptanalysis and the way that enemy codes and ciphers were broken and intelligence was produced. You'll read about the effect that Ultra had on operations. What you'll rarely see is much discussion of all of these knotty problems of security. If you could sit in at a meeting between Denniston and Travis and their senior managers in 1941, I bet that much of what they'd be talking about would be security. The intelligence production was happening, it was being disseminated, but the protection of the source, making sure that they'd be able to continue to produce intelligence, was of perhaps as great moment to them as what they were producing.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.